Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Cancer Q&A. This is a day we address common questions posed by patients with relapse refractory multiple myeloma. My program is being done in partnership with Cancer Care and the Blood Cancer Patient Support Group that helped us find the patients we talked to for this program. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Natalie Callender from the University of Wisconsin-Carbone Cancer Center in Madison, Wisconsin, and Dr. Sagar Loniel from the Winship Cancer Institute and Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta. We also have four other giants in the field of myeloma who took a survey that you'll see the results of. We're very grateful for their participation as well. Today, we're here to talk about multiple myeloma. And this is actually the second conference we did with a similar format. I'll just mention that as in all of our programs, we may discuss the use of unapproved agents and regimens. For any more information, check out the package inserts of the products that we talk about. So this is the second conference that we did with the same format. We did one a couple weeks ago, same faculty, Drs. Callender and Loniel, but this one was targeting patients. And for both of these conferences, I did individual Zoom recordings with nine people with relapsed myeloma. Some are patients of the faculty and others from other physicians. And basically, I asked them what would they like to hear discussed in a conference for patients. And we dealt with that in the other conference, but also I took a lot of what I heard from them and tried to turn it around into something that I thought would be useful to discuss. So basically, we have a playlist here. No Kaplan-Meier curves, no waterfall plots. We're just here to talk, listen to the patients, and also take a look at this survey, which I think you're going to find really interesting. So we're going to begin with the first video about some of the issues that come up with newly diagnosed patients. We're going to talk about refractory disease, but some of these questions come up from the very beginning in terms of why people have developed the disease and what to expect in the future. Here are some of their thoughts.
I don't know too many women that have multiple myeloma. It seems like most of the people I know are men. I really think I got mine from this stuff called Roundup, which is basically Agent Orange. And I had a 50-gallon tank. I'd go and spray my field lines, or fence lines with it. And I'd come in dripping wet in my hair, in my face, in my clothes.
One of the big things I have discussed with my doctor, also in support groups, about a cure for it. More information about that. And I believe, hopefully, there will be a cure one day.
One thing about myeloma patients is you never get to ring that bell that most patients that finish treatment. So I think it's important to realize when myeloma patients are in with everybody and they hear that bell, there's a little punch in the gut when you hear it.
So I had heard that thought, that last one before. We'll get into that in a second. But Natalie, I thought it was interesting this woman is a farmer. And as you heard, very much exposed. I was really surprised when I heard that history. She also brought up the fact that a couple of the patients said, hey, we see more men in the clinic than women. Why? I was wondering if maybe even there's a connection. We asked the faculty whether they think there's environmental toxins or insecticides might contribute. And most people say yes, including you, Natalie. Any comments?
Well, I think that there's pretty solid. I see there's a couple of disagreements here, but I think there's pretty solid epidemiological evidence. It's always hard to prove that for any specific patient, a certain contact is what caused their disease. But I think there is aggregated evidence that that there may be biohazards out there. And I think one of the interesting things about myeloma is it looks like the incidence is actually increasing throughout the world, and it's more than just aging population, at least on the data that I've seen. And one hypothesis is that maybe there are more pollutants and that may be causing sort of what we call chronic antigenic stimulation, and that can be a risk factor for the development of myeloma.
So, Sagar, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the 9/11 responders, my brother actually lives in New York, and he told me about this, and I didn't believe him until I saw the data. But it is inflammation, anything that causes inflammation. And so there are a couple of studies beginning to look at GLP-1 antagonists and whether they reduce inflammation and might prevent the development of myeloma from things like MGUS.
Mm-hmm. Wow. GLP-1 drugs, that's...
Yeah.
Interesting to say the least. So what about this other comment that myeloma patients don't get to ring the bell that, you know, people, for example, who finish adjuvant chemotherapy or breast cancer do? Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that a lot, and we talked about that in the patient conference, because mm-hmm. I wonder whether or not patients realize that maybe we have a different model with myeloma. And the more I thought about it, the more it kind of reminded me of CML, and with the hope that maybe we're moving towards a situation where maybe we won't be able to get everybody off therapy and quote cured, but maybe more like CML, where they might be able to stay on treatment that is, you know, pretty tolerable, and, you know, live a normal lifespan or die of something else. And Sagar, in that regard, I thought it was interesting. We asked the faculty to compare what they would say to a patient in 2005 to 2025 in terms of what to expect in terms of PFS and OS. And you can see here for a transplant eligible 65-year-old patient with standard risk, we've gone from a PFS of 36 months or, you know, in that range or so. Most people are saying 10 years or more. I've heard people say as high as 12 to 15 years or as more. When we look at a high-risk younger patient, we also see a jump, but of course the baseline is not as high. It's a pretty dramatic difference in terms of what you expect in terms of PFS. So, Sagar, anything you want to say first about this sort of profile of younger patients who are transplant eligible, what to expect, and what's contributed to this incredible jump in PFS and survival?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really a culmination of years and years of research in things like monoclonal antibodies. The moving of an anti-CD38 to upfront treatment has really revolutionized what we expect for PFS, and I think the continued use for high-dose therapy and transplant contributes to that. If you look at patients who get a quad up front but don't have a transplant, their first PFS is actually half of what you see for people who get a transplant. So I think, you know, there are a lot of people trying to de-escalate therapy. I think until we have that cure fraction higher, until we have more patients ringing the bell, I'm hesitant to turn down the volume on some of those important treatments.
Yeah, I mean, transplant obviously is a big issue, and I've been asking mm-hmm. questions about ever since the determination study was published. Mm-hmm. And actually, what you just said is something I wasn't really aware of. I was kind of surprised. And Natalie, here are the numbers when we say 80-year-old transplant ineligible. Mm-hmm. And just as Sagar was saying, you don't see the same kind of numbers even with quad therapy, although, again, they've jumped tremendously in the last 20 years, both in the high and low risk situation. Anything you want to add to that, Natalie? Who knows what's going to happen in 10 years also?
I think overall we've become more skillful as a community in treating older individuals. I remember a time where an older patient would come in, particularly maybe at the beginning in the early 2000s, where there were a lot of individuals who were told, "Don't bother getting any treatment at all. You're not going to tolerate it." And I think we're all pretty comfortable now at treating 80 and even 90-year-olds and figuring out that you really can give them excellent therapy without creating terrible side effects, and we just have more choices. And so I actually think these surveys are fascinating to me about how consistent they are. You know, everybody, maybe they're a little bit, but pretty much everybody's coming in the same sort of ballpark, I think.
Yeah, we've done a lot of surveys, investigators like that. I remember we did one with HER2-positive breast cancer. Just as you said, we had 20 investigators. They gave very similar numbers in terms of mm-hmm. what to expect. So Dilip in the chat room is all on top of it mm-hmm. saying... functional cure concept. And one mm-hmm. of the things I was thinking about also, I don't know if you, I'm sure a lot of people in the audience remember, but of course, a third of our audience is pretty new to oncology. There used to be a model in breast cancer called the adjuvant online, where you would put in different, how many nodes they had, and what treatment they mm-hmm. got, and it would tell you what the treatment benefit was. But one of the things they included in that was risk of dying of something else. And so as patients got into their 80s and 90s, you could see the numbers changing because they were dying of other things. And, you know, again, it ties into this concept of, functional cure. And we say, I mean, it's not unusual for you to see an 80-year-old patient, right? But think about even a healthy 80-year-old patient, what their median life expectancy is, even if they don't have myeloma. And here we say now, given the treatments that we have, what's the likelihood that an 80-year-old patient is going to die of something else? And the answer is most of them are going to die of something else at age 80. And even 90, of course, it increases. Sagar, any thoughts about that and this idea of functional cure? And do you think we'll get to a point where we can really stop therapy completely?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the outlook, particularly for older patients, is significantly improved. And we're actually going back through our RVD 1000 series right now and looking for people who are in remission for more than 10 years and trying to identify what factors identified who they were. And one of the things we're noticing is that a lot of those folks are not dying of myeloma. They're dying of something else, just as you described. So I think that's absolutely a real phenomenon. And as people live longer, the proportion starts to go up a little bit. I think the other question about discontinuation of therapy, I think it depends on the right setting and with the right data. And what I'd say is that I think that current treatments, things like CARs and bispecifics, are more likely to get us to a point where we can stop therapy than the previous generation of IMIDs and proteasome inhibitors, where you probably did need some level of continuous therapy in order to control a very small clone.
So we could spend a lot of time, and actually we're just sending in an abstract to ASH of another survey we did of investigators asking about their usual first-line practices. We found a lot of investigators looking at MRD, and Swati in the chat room wants to know whether or not MRD, and we'll talk about that. That's one of the questions the patient had, but in terms of discontinuing treatment, do you see Sagar MRD as a path towards being able to discontinue treatment?
So I'm going to differentiate early MRD, meaning within the first year, and late MRD, meaning year two, year three, year four. In that context, when it's sustained, I think it's certainly reasonable, particularly for patients who are having trouble tolerating maintenance, to talk about discontinuation. I think I've said before, I'm very nervous about doing that within the first year to make a treatment decision.
Right. All right, well, we'll go back to the patients here. And another thing that they all commented on was their interest in clinical trials. A number of these people have been on clinical trials. Here are some thoughts they had.
I'm a big supporter of clinical trials. The experiences I've had with the clinical trials is that it's kind of like you get special treatment.
What's next in the pipeline? What's coming down the road? I've gone from one new treatment to the next, and I'm going to keep going.
I'm curious if you hear patients talk about the MRD assay.
It seems as though it's giving people false sense of hopes of being cured. And everybody's saying, oh, you know, I'm MRD negative and I'm cured. I'm on a Facebook group and, you know, everyone's just high-fiving each other about the MRD negative and everybody's cancer-free. And it's throwing people for a loop.
So, and here are some of the faculty's thoughts. We just heard from Natalie and Sagar about MRD, and you can see most of these people are using. We saw in our survey that we sent the abstract in that it was a pretty frequently considered in the maintenance, post-transplant maintenance setting. We saw a pretty big difference in what people did, particularly what they chose to use. We also had another question we showed to the patients, Natalie, in terms of what fraction of patients who enter clinical trials nowadays benefit? And, you know, because you hear that patient, I've heard tons of patients, who, particularly from you all, people who go from trial to trial.
Right.
We did some videos with patients a couple years ago, and I did a video of a patient, and I think about the day or in the same week that I did the video, teclistamab was approved, and this man had been on it for a year and a half, like doing great. To me, that was always a classic case of the potential benefits. Sagar, any thoughts about this idea of, you know, now, you know, particularly again, for the people new to oncology, what clinical trials, not just in myeloma, but I think all through oncology, are offering patients now compared to in the past?
Yeah, I mean, I think the likelihood of responding even on a phase one trial in myeloma is not the 7% that it was 25 or 30 years ago. I think we've got much better rationale. We've got much better models. And so, I've got somebody who was on the original phase one trial of RVD 20 years ago that's still on study and doing well. So at least in my experience, people can get significant benefit even when they have other options to choose from. But Natalie, I'm sure you've got the same.
Yeah, I know. I think it's, I have a person who is on the, just like you, on SWOG 777 and has never been treated with anything else, actually. And so I think the first patient, I totally agree. I'm sure Sagar does the same thing. We all try to have sort of a study for every situation. If you can do it, that's the ideal. And Sagar's right, is that these days we really can confidently, in most cases, offer somebody a treatment that we think is going to be at least as good and maybe better. And I think that's a really wonderful place for patients to be in. And I think, all of their contributions are huge. I mean, we wouldn't be where we are right now if all these individuals wouldn't be participating in the trials.
The next two videos get into two of the key issues in relapse disease, CAR T therapy and bispecifics. Mm-hmm. I was kind of thinking that, a few years ago before, it wasn't that long ago that we didn't have CAR T or bispecific. In those days, which, like I said, it wasn't that long ago, people would go like, how do you make a decision? And now to me, now that these really effective agents of algorithm, at least initially, is getting a lot more straightforward. And again, we could talk for an hour about each one of these, but I just want to give you a little glimpse of some of the things that I heard from some of the patients who experienced CAR T. How was the CAR T? How was it going through that experience for you?
Compared to the stem cell transplant, it was a piece of cake. Having so much time with people and being isolated and the people I was with was challenging. I like that it's one and done, and then I can move on instead of always having to go in.
We got a list of neurological things to look for, but I had stuttering for 3 weeks.
Really?
I also couldn't walk in a straight line for about a week. But both of those symptoms didn't start until I had been home a couple of months.
One of the side effects that I personally have from CAR T is I have a tick in my left arm now. So my left arm will just start shaking almost like I have Parkinson's or something, a Parkinson's type something. It just, my left arm just will shake all the time.
So Natalie, it was kind of surprising just to hear people verbalize things that I'd seen statistics on. I was kind of surprised about the way it was manifested in terms of, for example, stuttering. And also the fact that some of this was delayed. And, our primary target audience is a general oncologist. So they may, or they're not going to treat the patient with CAR T, but they're going to see them afterwards. Any thoughts about what you see, particularly in terms of neurologic issues?
Yeah, I think we're still at the beginning of understanding the neurological toxicities and what causes them and also how to manage them appropriately. I think it's pretty clear that, and Sagar, I don't know if you agree with this or not, we're trying to lower the amount of myeloma before people go through CAR T. We think that can be associated with a lower risk of complications, but sometimes they show up despite that. And I think we just don't understand exactly why they do, particularly the delayed ones. I think sometimes the earlier neurological side effects are easier to at least we think it's easier to understand, but some of the delayed ones, which are quite serious, I think that can be a reason why, for example, I am not offering CAR T to every single person at first relapse. I think there's still some things that we would like to get better. I don't know, Sagar, if you agree with that or not.
Yeah, I don't think we have a good way right now to gauge expansion kinetics.
Right.
We know that there's a wave of expansion early on, and that's what leads to some of the early side effects. But there may be a second wave that I don't think we, in general, know exactly how to quantify or predict. And that probably leads to some of those late neurologic side effects as well. We're offering it to people with high risk disease and first relapse, and I'm having the conversation with everybody, but certainly that's certainly where we're doing it, similar to what you're doing.
And here are some of the thoughts of the faculty. One, in terms of the issue of sequencing, of course, you heard the patient verbalize her satisfaction of being off therapy, and that may have a lot to do with why people generally start with CAR-T before bispecifics. We also asked people, like, what do they think the risk is of neurologic issues with the two preparations for CAR-T? Of course, we've heard more about it with Cilta-cel. I was surprised at some of these numbers for Ide-cel, but again, a little bit higher for Cilta-cel. Also, I was kind of curious, what was the age of the oldest patient receiving CAR-T? And you can see here it's in the low 80s. Interesting, a lot of these people got Cilta-cel, which I thought was also interesting. Sagar, any comments, again, on sequencing and the benefits of being off therapy, and also what the patient mentioned about having people around her all the time when she felt well, I guess, when she was getting the CAR-T?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sequencing, if all things are equal and you have time, would be to collect the product for a CAR before you potentially dose with a bispecific. Now that's, again, it's everybody's not going to want to do that, and everybody's not going to want a CAR. But I think the thought process is, if somebody progresses 2 or 3 years after a CAR, you may be able to reuse that target again in the context of a bispecific. Whereas if they progress on a bispecific, the likelihood that they don't have something functionally wrong with BCMA is lower, because we just are seeing a fair number of mutations in that context. Now, that may change as we discontinue bispecifics, because I think that's coming in the future as well.
So and here are a couple of patients who got bispecifics, and I was kind of surprised. You know, again, I'm not seeing patients anymore, but I sort of had the impression that, for example, teclistamab was very well tolerated, no problems. But at least for these two people, that wasn't quite the case.
How effective is CAR-T? For me, it was the best thing to happen for me, because I went off of chemo for a year and a half. That was wonderful. But I'd like to know how other patients responded to these drugs like CAR-T. And the one, this, I guess it's teclistamab that I'm on.
How's that been for you?
Well, I love it. I feel a little poopy like 48 hours later, not the next day. I just feel kind of draggy. Right now, I couldn't be happier. I just hope it will hold up.
What was it like when you got the first treatment?
Well, the first one I had kind of a reaction, but not terrible. The second one I had no reaction. I thought I'm home free. The third one was a killer. It was like triple the dose. I had like 105 fever. I was throwing up. My blood pressure dropped out. It was, they said I was minutes away from intensive care. But then it all turned around.
And I've been on teclistamab for almost 2 years. This is the longest that I've gone in response for this amount of time. And so I'm just trying to enjoy the ride.
Any side effects or issues with the teclistamab?
Yes. So teclistamab was the hardest drug that I actually ever went on. I had the side effects from the very first dosage. I was disorientated. I had nausea. I had body aches, hand tremors, body tremors. It was a really, really tough time. And it didn't straighten out for about 4 months. And then it got much better.
And now, do you have any side effects from it?
No. I was also in the hospital with a woman who was at least 20 years older than me, and she was skipping around, and she had her second dose. So, you know, it just goes to show you that no two apples are the same.
So, Natalie, again, I was kind of surprised. I don't know if this is typical or atypical.
No, I think you do see variations in how people respond to these initially in terms of CRS symptoms and less ICANS. I haven't had a big problem with that, but there are some people who have quite significant symptoms, but they tend to be very early and they don't tend to last, which has been great. For the BCMA-targeted bispecifics, I think the biggest issue we see patients confronting later on is the infection risk. And we at our program, we really try to emphasize this is serious business and that you really have to take a fever and a cough seriously, and that really can be problematic for people on BCMA targeted therapies.
Yeah,
anything
you know,
one of the things that, Sagar?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have done routinely now for anybody getting a bispecific is to give what we call preemptive tocilizumab, because you know, if you're talking about the average age of a myeloma patient is in their 70s, and the incidence of any CRS is about 70%, what's the upside of letting a 75-year-old get a heart rate of 120 and drop their blood pressure? There's no upside to that. And so by giving preemptive TOCI, we reduce any CRS to about 20 to 21%, and it allows us to do most of our bispecifics, even the step-up dosing, as an outpatient. Which again, patients like as well. So I just think, you know, we give prophylactic G-CSF right. for a lower bar than this. Yeah. And it should be standard practice. I don't see a downside.
Yeah, you know, for the last couple of years, we've been delving into this issue of who should start bispecifics and when do they come back to the community and the community doesn't carry mm-hmm. TOCI. And, you know, I do these one-on-one Zoom sessions with general oncologists all the time. And I was doing one last week with a doc from North Carolina. I was asking about bispecifics. He doesn't even send them to the tertiary center. They treat, they give preemptive TOCI, have no problem at all. I was surprised, actually, to hear that. Any other thoughts? There's some more from the survey. You know, I was saying that to me, it seems like the algorithm for relapse disease has gotten a lot simpler because it's like you all say here, you want to use bispecific as early as you can. And I don't even know if there's an age limit. We did ask, I think, what the oldest of the patient was. Again, here, you know, Newport had a 91-year-old patient. You can see which agents are used. Any comments, Natalie, in terms of, first of all, is there an age or comorbidity where you wouldn't use a bispecific? Where would you like to use it?
Well, I actually feel that we're learning, particularly in this older population, how to use these effectively. And I think a little goes a long way is kind of the theme here, in that we often will have one of our 80-year-old patients do step-up dosing and then actually pause for, just to sort of make sure that they don't have any toxicities. These drugs are quite effective. And it almost appears in some ways that they're almost more potent in these older individuals. So we try to use them very sparingly. And I think you just, again, a little goes a long way, but we treat 80-year-olds pretty frequently.
Sagar, any thoughts about where bispecifics are going to land? Obviously the question of first line therapy, do you see it being combined like a quintuplet or more like in maintenance? What are the trials looking at?
Yeah, I mean, there are several phase 3 trials looking at TEC as part of an upfront induction regimen, the same with ELRA. And so I think these are going to be brought earlier and earlier. I have a little bit of concern about combining them with an anti-CD38 as part of frontline therapy. I know a lot of trials are doing that. But the infection risk is higher, and a patient at diagnosis is already at a higher risk of infections than even a relapse patient is. And so I think a sequential approach or partnering it with drugs might be the better way to go, but let's see what the data looks like. What I've seen so far, almost everybody achieves MRD negativity. The question is what's the age limit on being able to take that much immunosuppression as part of your initial induction?
I was just flashing on MRD is the new PSA, but that's another story. We were talking about preemptive. yeah, that's an incredible story, as a matter of fact. So we were talking about preemptive TOCI. It's kind of an interesting example. While everybody doesn't do the same as Sagar, which he just said he used it, Natalie typically doesn't. Neither does Dr. Fonseca. Dr. Richardson does, has a low threshold to use it. Sagar, do you think that it's reasonable for a community-based general medical oncologist, same doctor taking care of breast cancer, bladder cancer, et cetera, to start bispecific themselves, use preemptive TOCI, and do they need to put them in the hospital?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything. I mean, there's a little bit of a learning curve, but I don't think there's anything that a general oncologist can't do to provide the care to these patients. What I think they may need to ensure they have is the support team to take care of them at 2 a.m. Where is that patient going to go if they are that 20% that gets CRS? And can they get something like TOSI or can they get corticosteroids quickly? So I think that's really the only logistic hurdle that needs to be sorted out. But the skill set of an oncologist should be able to handle this. And they're doing this now with the bispecific for small cell lung cancer. So I think it's applying that to a different patient population.
Yeah, we actually just did a webinar last week on that. And of course, we were talking about tarlatamab. I thought that was going to be a nightmare with small cell patients, but it really doesn't seem to be that much of a problem. It's clearly now the new paper that just came out at ASCO going to be second line and probably maybe is going to end up in a maintenance situation. Mm-hmm. I remember it wasn't that long ago when HMA venetoclax came out for AML, and you know, community-based oncologists weren't even treating AML that much. Right. And they were like, how are we going to do HMA venetoclax? And now, no problem. So I think probably maybe the same thing will happen with bispecifics. So let's talk about something we actually seem to talk about all the time in solid tumors and a lot of hematologic cancers. Not so much in the myeloma, but there is certainly one very interesting antibody-drug conjugate that's on everybody's radar, particularly with some of the things that have happened the last few weeks with the FDA, belantamab mafodotin. And Natalie, this is actually your patient. I interviewed another. This man has been on a trial and still on the trial of belantamab. For 3 years. There was another patient I interviewed, we're not going to show tonight, who's been on it for 4 years, both of them doing really well. I'm going to show what he says about what happened when he got the first dose in terms of ophthalmic toxicity. But can you kind of put the setting of what was going on with him when he first got the belantamab and what it's been like to take care of him?
Well, he was an individual who had been in a number of different studies. He actually started off on an ECOG trial that deferred transplant, and so he actually received carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone up front, and did pretty well for a while, but eventually he never actually entered a remission, and we ended up taking him to transplant and also did not go into remission despite some maintenance. He went on daratumumab for a while and in combination, and then this study opportunity came up, and he's actually had the best response he's ever had on this drug. This is the only time he's been in a complete remission.
You know, we hear that story a lot with ADCs nowadays. You know, trastuzumab deruxtecan and HER2-positive breast cancer, incredible responses. We just saw at ASCO, now it just got moved up to first line. But of course, the issue, and this is what came up in the FDA, and we're going to ask Sagar to give us a little behind the scenes view of what he wants to say about what happened with the FDA. But here's this patient talking about what happened when he first got treated with belantamab.
When I first started getting treatment, I got the full dose that they give to start. And I'm pretty susceptible to the corneal little cysts that you get. And so I got it really bad right after the first one. I had to buy myself a magnifying glass about that big so that I could look at anything or read anything. And it took, I think, probably the full 9 weeks to get so that I was better. But after that, I get cysts, but they're in the corners of my eyes. And they distort the cornea a little bit so that if I'm looking at point sources, I can see that there are a bunch of little point sources overlapping. But, you know, your head takes care of that. And other than that, I've got better than 20/20 vision. And so it really hasn't bothered me.
When you think about it, how much of a problem has the eye issue been for you?
Aside from the fact that I have to remember to put drops in, it's not been an annoyance at all.
So, Sagar, I was telling you, we just did this webinar with Neil Parrish, who's an ophthalmologist, worked with Hope Rubo at UCSF, who Hope left to go to City of Hope. And he has a vision of, you know, antibody-drug conjugates in general, not just belantamab or mirvetuximab, having this effect on the cornea. He's done research on the cornea. He's a cornea researcher. He says that unlike systemic chemotherapy, ADCs get picked up by the corneal epithelium. Any thoughts about this man's story, what he described, and also would you like to give us a little insight into what happened with the FDA?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the story he describes is not uncommon in the sense that Everybody's going to react to that first dose a little bit differently. And so in order to get an effective therapeutic first dose, most patients are going to have some ocular toxicity. And you then adjust the dose and schedule once you see what that is for a given patient and they're responding. And I think his story after that first dose is also not uncommon for people who get Belamaf. They have a problem with that first dose and then subsequent doses. We figured out, it sounds like Natalie figured it out pretty quickly, and made the right dose and schedule adjustment. You know, I think the theory by the ophthalmologist makes a lot of sense. There has to be something unique about the corneal epithelial layer that allows it to be more susceptible to these kind of ADC-based approaches. You know, I think the FDA, just perhaps is trying to learn and understand what to expect from some of these ocular toxicities. You know, when we first went to the FDA at ODAC for Belamaf's initial approval, there was a medical oncologist on the ODAC who said, we have a GU drug that does the same thing, and we figured it out. I don't know why the myeloma docs can't figure it out. We didn't have that doc on the panel this time, so I don't think we got that same vote of confidence. But I think there is a learning curve. I think it is certainly an incredibly effective drug. And the story that Natalie told us about this patient who'd never achieved a CR and is now in CR happens all the time with Belamaf. And I just think we have to, it's an important drug for our patients to have access to.
So, and I'm curious, so we'll go come back to Sagar in a second about what's going to come. Now, the actual formal decision for the FDA is going to be made, I guess, in a couple of months. This is just ODAC. It's interesting, too, when we asked these, you know, again, you can't find a more prestigious group of myeloma doctors. How many patients in your practice, if you had Belantamab available right now, would you treat with the drug? So people are ready to use it and feel comfortable using it. We also asked where they would use it. There's a lot of variation. Natalie, any perspective on this patient and your experience with the agent?
Right. I think one thing that we alluded to, this particular patient was on a Q3-week dosing schedule. That's how the study was put together, which we all know in practical experience, it's, you don't need to do that. That was one issue. But as Sagar said, there are patients who just had incredible responses. It's, you can give it infrequently. You know, we have patients that we've used on compassionate use that are quarterly, you know, every 3 months, do great. You don't have to give steroids. It's a quick infusion. It's really something that is very useful, and I really do hope the FDA approves it in October.
So when we survey oncologists, they kind of are aware that the DREAM studies were positive, but not necessarily the degree of I was shocked when I saw, you know, compare Pom Dex Dara to Pom Dex Belantamab, hazard rate of 0.5 for Belantamab. Most people don't know that number, but it kind of supports what you're saying. Sagar, what about the issue of BCMA after BCMA? We have bispecifics, et cetera. Do you see that as much of an issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to understand mechanisms of resistance. And I think we were starting to get that with Bella with its initial approval, and then when it got pulled, we didn't really have a chance to explore that in more detail. I think we're learning, for instance, that with the bispecific, the mechanism of resistance is likely the development of mutations in BCMA, at least the way we currently give it. And the question is, are there certain mutations that still allow Bella to bind? And so I think there's a lot of work to understand, but I think we're going to see more and more of this as we begin to use these agents more often.
We also asked the faculty where they thought Belamaf was going to fit in now and maybe in the future. And Sagar, you were telling me about a fascinating trial, I guess, in high-risk patients looking at Belamaf as maintenance, which I think sounds really cool. And particularly if you can get patients on a dose that, you know, where they don't really mind it, might be much more tolerable than some of our other maintenance regimens. Any comments on that study, Sagar?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you've hit all of the main reasons why it's so appealing to patients. You know, our current high-risk maintenance off study is carfilzomib with pomalidomide, which means they're coming in once every 3 weeks out of every 4 for 3 years. this, the Bela-Pom-Dex trial, they come in every 8 weeks to get Bela, and otherwise they're taking Pom-Dex, which is those are pills, right? So patients are sort of really wanting to be on this study, even though they have high risk disease, and the efficacy is looking really pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see what happens. You know, I when we did this program on ophthalmic issues, I was saying keratitis is the new neutropenia.
Right.
Because really, keratitis is an issue with to some extent with all ADCs. Some of them is very little, some a lot. You can dose reduce, you can change the schedule and you know adapt. And I think this is one of the most interesting questions we asked. I think you should maybe send this to the FDA. If belantamab were available, do you think that you'd be able to avoid significant ophthalmic toxicity by modifying the dose and schedule administration? We call this a consensus because everybody says yes. That's how we do our consensus. If everybody says this is what I do, then I call that. All right, so a few other issues just to fly through to, again, bring the patient back into the discussion. Yeah. We talked about the challenge of making decisions in the relapse setting. Here's a couple of thoughts from patients related to that.
When I talk with my doctor, she will have a variety of things that are available. One of the questions that I have is, with all the developments that they've had in treatments, how do you go about deciding what would be a reasonable one? What's a poor doctor to do in these days for their relapse patients? How do they go about deciding what is a reasonable next course?
How do you direct patients who are unsure which direction to take their treatments? So there's so many options, mm-hmm. A, B, C, or D.
Have you yourself been in a situation where you were presented with multiple options?
For sure. And I always turn to my medical person and I say, well, if I were your mother or your daughter, what would you do? And I think I always get the right answer.
So Natalie, any thoughts? As I was saying, I feel like maybe it's kind of getting more straightforward how to at least initially, man, I don't know about post-bispecific or post-bispecific CAR-T, but that seems to be a little bit more straightforward moving forward. And how do you respond when a patient says, what would you do if it were you?
Well, I think the setting and the nature of the relapse is really important because we have a lot of patients these days that have what we would call a biochemical progression, which people use that term just to say the lab values are changing. You get the proteins going up, but they're asymptomatic. And, you know, there are some of those patients that I think we will maybe observe for a while. Whether or not that should be an early intervention, one of Sagar's colleagues, Dr. Kaufman, is trying to put together a trial to look at that specifically. But it's a much more difficult situation if somebody is on, say, triple therapy or triple maintenance at the time that they progress. Those patients are going to be more difficult, and those are probably the ones that we're going to steer towards a cellular therapy option earlier rather than later. And so, and then of course, we always take into account what other side effects have they had from their previous treatment. That makes a big difference. How far away are they from the clinic? I mean, all of those things are factored into when we talk to patients about treating a relapse.
So I was just thinking, I guess you all got your new fellows in July. So yeah. Sagar, what do you say about relapse myeloma to the fellows who are just starting out?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think Natalie summarized it really nicely in terms of all the factors we think through. You know, I think with a lot of folks getting Dara as part of their initial therapy, is it going to be a Dara-based salvage? When are you going to actually start therapy? You know, for a standard risk patient, I just saw somebody who, after 15 years, now has a protein of 0.3. They, in a panic, came up to see me. And, you know, I said, the only thing I would do is I would get a PET to make sure we're not missing anything. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I'm not in any hurry to do anything. You've had standard risk disease. You've done well for a long time. I don't even know that we need to do a marrow today. Let's mm-hmm. see what the tempo of that relapse is before we make a decision on where to go next. And so I still fall back on the hardest thing for us in medicine to do is nothing.
Yeah.
But sometimes waiting and letting the patient tell you what they need over time, as opposed to making a quick decision, is sometimes the best measure.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it kind of brings in the issue of initial treatment. And, you know, what it takes to start treatment. And maybe it sounds like, in a way, you're kind of taking a similar approach in the relapse setting. So another issue, and this is kind of like some clinical pearl type of giving you the opportunity to give your own particular issue. And almost every one of these patients brought up the issue of neuropathy, even if they were doing great. Here's a couple of them.
The RVD caused severe neuropathy, and I lost all feeling below my knees.
Do you still have the neuropathy now?
Oh, yes, sir. I have absolutely no feelings from the knees down. I was on huge doses of gabapentin that first year, and it didn't seem to do anything.
Anything you've been treated with or done that helped the neuropathy?
I had acupuncture and massage once a week for 2 years, and it made a significant difference in my pain levels.
So, Natalie, I was a little surprised about what the man described. It seemed like more than, you know, what I was kind of expecting. Also, it brings up the issue, do you ever switch from bortezomib to carfilzomib if somebody, like after one dose, is starting to get neuropathy?
Absolutely. I mean, there are individuals, and somebody gave a great talk a number of years ago about this, that really seemed to have some sort of polymorphism that leads them to develop neuropathy very quickly. And I think we also went through the era where bortezomib was IV, and you would basically assume every patient was going to develop neuropathy. I think one of the keys in terms of when you were looking for pearls, I think it's really important if a person comes in with just even a little bit of neuropathy to really take that seriously, because it tends to even progress once you stop the drug. So you have to be really careful about this. And I'm sure in the old days, you know, Sagar has seen individuals. I saw several that just sort of seared my brain. People who came in and they were thought to have cord compression, and what they really had was terrible neuropathy from bortezomib that wasn't recognized. And so that is fortunately very unusual to see that these days. But back when the drug was just getting used, that would happen.
So Sagar, yeah. Any comments? And I was just thinking about our surveys. We can even do indirect comparisons in our surveys, like you guys do with clinical trials. So here's how they rate gabapentin 1 to 5 as a 3, like okay. But here's how the people rate acupuncture, which is a 4, more a little bit better from a lot of people. Any thoughts? I kind of imagine there's probably a lot more gabapentin being used in acupuncture. But any comments, Sagar?
Yeah, that really rapid progressive neuropathy with just a few doses, we've tended to see more in African American patients, not so much in the non-African American patients. But what's interesting is this is where the team-based approach is so important. So we early on trained our nurses in the infusion center to ask about neuropathy with each dose of bortezomib. And by doing that, we've been able to reduce the severe ones like this poor gentleman had in that case. And I will tell you, I was skeptical about acupuncture. It has worked miracles in some of these patients. Some patients have had neuropathy for a long time, and our acupuncture team, our integrative oncology team, came to me and said, why are you not sending us more? And so we started sending some of the worst cases, and most of them are getting better. It's pretty cool.
Where do they actually put the needles?
It is group acupuncture at our place. That's what's provided for free by our integrative oncology team. I don't know where they put it. I haven't sat in on a session.
I think that's the first question I have asked you in 20 years you didn't know the answer to. I'm pretty proud of that. I'm just kidding. All right. Here's another one as we get more into, again, these are some of the things the patients were asking about. A lot of questions about diet, nutrition, and alternative therapy. Mm-hmm. Here's what one patient said.
I want to know about marijuana and THC. Is that helpful? I have a infrared sauna sitting right here next to me. I have red light. I drink greens powder, and I have compounded supplements that are made just for me. Lots of questions about traveling. Very worried about my bones. So, you know, about caffeine, and then worried about alcohol, you know, and Dr. O'Neill is like, yeah, have a glass of wine, have a cookie, right? He's much more sure. And I'm like, I don't know.
Somehow it didn't surprise me to hear that. Natalie, any comments that we, again, right. asked our audience about, we asked the faculty, but any comments?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we probably really do have to get a little smarter about is asking patients directly what they are taking, because you would be horrified, I think, sometimes. A colleague of mine was just telling me about a patient who came in with just terrible pancytopenia and alopecia and was taking both ivermectin and albendazole, which is another anti-helminthic drug, and just sort of wiped out their bone marrow to the point that they were poised to think about transplant. And so so I think, you know, that's obviously an extreme situation, but I do think that people are actually taking a lot of things that we're not aware of. And I think it is, you know, it is sort of moderation to Sagar's point, what he told this patient. Maybe that's kind of boring, but I think that's often really what you do need to tell people. And I usually emphasize fruits and vegetables. If you want to get nutrients, eat it in the real source.
So, Sagar, when we brought this up, I was surprised because you talked about some work that you did that I wasn't aware of, looking at daily green tea supplements, which we asked. It looks like the faculty was aware of the fact that you had demonstrated, you can talk about the research, you know, potential interaction with bortezomib as well as daily vitamin C supplements. Any comments about the studies you did and sort of how you think about approaching patients?
Yeah, I mean, what I end up telling most patients is the ones we tested were vitamin C and green tea, and we know that they both do interfere with bortezomib. We haven't tested most supplements out there, and so I'd say my answer is, do you want to risk an interaction that may limit the efficacy or add to the toxicity of the treatment? I'm not going to tell you not to do it. I'm just going to tell you I don't think it's a good idea unless we had data that it doesn't interfere. And we just don't have that data for most of them.
So here are some other questions we asked about whether people actually ask patients about the use of dietary supplements or alternative therapies. And most people say yes, that they do or they try to. Also, an estimate of what fraction of people are doing some type of activity. I don't know if to the extent of the patient we just showed. But again, and I don't know if there are surveys that have been done. Any other alternative strategies, Natalie, that concern you? I was thinking back to the stock I was mentioning, who's using preventive Itoci. He was telling me, like, he had this patient who had persistent neutropenia and found out the patient was on, what is it, ivermectin?
Ivermectin.
I was wondering if that could cause it. Yeah. He says, like, all his patients are taking that.
I do try to emphasize to patients that supplements are not regulated. So number one, you don't even know what's in them. And then secondly, they're expensive and people spend a lot of money on them. And I think that's something that I really say, if you want to join a study where they're looking at that or something maybe more organized, that sounds great to me. But I don't think that there's a lot of information that, you know, you can even talk about a multivitamin. I don't think we have a lot of information that really helps, maintain your health. So I usually counsel them that I don't think it's worth the money most of the time.
And, you know, I mean, with the ivermectin story, I don't know that I have anybody on it. I know Jonathan, my colleague, does. We spend so much time and effort looking at phase two and phase three trials to make treatment decisions. There's no data on ivermectin. So it's frustrating that it can only get in the way. It's not going to help.
So the last video I just put in there, it's kind of a fun comment, but also to kind of get your thoughts, again, thinking back to the fact that we have a lot of fellows, who utilize our content just coming into oncology, how you approach patients and their families in terms of, you know, your kind of clinical pearls about communicating with them, answering their questions. Here's what this patient said.
I come into every appointment with a list of questions. When I had my 100-day checkup after the stem cell transplant, I had over 100 questions. And one of the other doctors, she's like, you cannot ask Dr. O'Neill 164 questions. You need to come up with 6. So I went in and I told him what happened. He's like, go ahead, let's do this. And I said, are you sure? And he's like, absolutely.
Sagar, again, I wasn't surprised to hear that, but any sort of pearls you pass on to your fellows about interacting with not just patients, but their families?
Yeah, I think they do often have a lot of questions, particularly early on. And I think you want to build that trust early on. And so you take it. You're usually not going to go through the entire list. If you go through the first, you know, 7 or 8 and you show them that you're really taking time to answer it, that's usually sufficient. And then you've probably addressed half of the other ones already. But I think, you know, patients are anxious. This is a new vernacular for them. They don't know all the answers. And quite honestly, you think you told them, but they don't remember that visit because they were drinking from a fire hose at that visit. So you just have to be, flexible. You have to be patient, which are not skills we often have.
Yeah, and I tell people
that. Those are
tough ones. Yeah, this is one of those situations, particularly when it's an initial diagnosis, that you really need to turn off the machines, face the patient, take a seat, show that you are willing to spend the time. And I think, you know, eye contact and turning towards the patient, I mean, these may seem like very basic things, but in the day of computers and everybody's trying to get their notes done at the same time, sometimes that really goes by the wayside. And I will totally agree with Sagar. I've had patients who I suspect on the 80th visit, when I've told them again what an M protein is, I'm sure you've had patients like that. It's still unclear to them what we're talking about, but you know, I think that that's part of our job is to try to make it as understandable. And these therapeutic situations, they are relationships. They are really a team that you are forming with the patient and their family. And things you need to have that foundation, because great things can happen, but some really bad things can happen. And I think you want to have that confidence that in the patients and the families and your care and your team's care.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talk about the bond that heals, you know, just the bond you have with the patient, their family, beyond any anti-tumor effect having benefited. Mm-hmm. Sagar, you were going to say something?
I was just going to say that, you know, your description is absolutely correct, the bond piece. I think that's, to me, what makes the challenge of oncology so much more palatable, is the idea that you do build those bonds and you do build those relationships. I saw somebody who presented with plasma cell leukemia in 2012 on Tuesday. They're off therapy and ongoing complete remission, despite the fact they had 17p deletion at diagnosis. That's a great story. That's why we're here, right? To have that kind of outcome.
So Dilip in the chat room says, green tea has a lot of chromium, and chromium is in fat burners. I'm not sure what a fat burner is, and it's neurotoxic. And Claudia says, I think lack of assessment of neuropathy contributes a lot to the severity of the neuropathy that's seen. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, sort of picking up what you were saying, Sagar. I want to really thank the 9 patients who sat down with me and chatted with me. I hope I reflected on some of the many questions that they had. And it's really been a great experience talking about this today. I got to throw in one quick first-line question. I'm just kind of curious. I'll start with you, Natalie. You know, I talked to Dr. Leloup, and he was telling me about the on-body sub-Q delivery system that isatuximab was presented at ASCO. And he actually presented a case of a patient being treated at home. I'm just kind of curious how you think choice of CD38 antibody in the upfront setting may or may not change with the introduction of this new on-body device compared to Dara's.
I actually think it'll change a lot, because I think that's really what's limited the use of isatuximab, is particularly in combinations like with pomalidomide, when the patient is hoping to be in and out very quickly. That's limited the use. Carfilzomib is what we tend to use isatuximab with the most, because they're coming in already for intravenous care. But I think it's going to make a big difference, and that device is really slick.
Yeah, it seems pretty cool. Sagar, have you ever used it, or any thoughts about it?
We've not used it yet, but I think we're on a trial that's going to give us access to it. And I agree. I think it'll be really interesting, because it may change the workflow for a nurse, which is not inconsequential. That is actually really important. So let's see. I'm excited to at least try it once.
Yeah, it's tough to find people in the U.S. who've actually had experience with it. I was so pleased to talk to Dr. Leloup. Yeah. Anyhow, again, thanks to the patients, Natalie and Sagar. Thanks to you all.
Thank you.
Audience, thank you for attending as well. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Natalie. Thanks, Sagar.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good one.